Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Mickey Gray, the local lad that done well.
Mickey, welcome into the Ramble Meets studio. It's lovely to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much for giving up your time. What does football mean to you?
Well, everything, if I'm brutally honest with you. I think, you know, from as young as I can remember, when I was in the streets, because that's what we used to do, older brothers, best friends, you'd find a ball from somewhere or somebody would have one. And then it was the old jumpers for goalposts, or you'd play in the middle of the road and wait for the cars to go past and then you'd jump back onto it. I think like everybody used to do as a youngster. And then it was really strange to go from 7, 8, 9-year-old, 10, 11, 12, et cetera, you know, then starting to play with your friends on a Saturday and a Sunday and maybe the school team. And then you figure out after that, you know, when your parents are stood on the byline and you see the guys with the long coats going across to speak to your parents.
You remember that happening?
Yeah, I can, because we had a couple of good players in my team. One was Craig Russell, who used to obviously sign for Sunderland and then moved on to Manchester City. I mean, he was built like a man when he was young, you know, 13, 14 years old. He had thighs like Roberto Carlos. He was absolutely massive, he was. So you just seen these jackets walking around the outside of the pitches, and then you eventually saw the badges of what teams they were, etc. And Sunderland was there. There was Newcastle, Man United, Liverpool. There was so many. And I think they cottoned on to us having a good team. So they'd come and watch us. And that, and I knew that Craig was signed up with Sunderland at the time. I had an opportunity, but I remember the scout, Jim Hagen from Manchester United. He went across and started speaking to me, mum and dad, and I thought nothing of it. You know,
how old were you at the time, 13?
I was 13 years old, yeah.
Okay.
So then you kind of finish the game, you get in the back of the car, and your dad will just say, oh, Man United, there was a scout from Man United who just watched you, and he took your name, took the address and the phone number, etc. And then you don't think anything of it because you're just a school kid. You want to go back out and play with your mates after you played your Sunday league game. And then I think the phone went because it was just house phones then.
Yeah.
And mum and dad picked the phone up. They had a long conversation. Then they put me on the phone and it was like, right, do you want to go for some trials at Manchester United? At Chesley Street they were, actually.
Yeah.
Did a couple of trials there and they picked, well, funny enough, they picked two players. And it was, one of them was me and another guy was called Paul Gough. Talented midfield player, but never eventually made it. You know, he didn't really have the pace to play centre midfield. Wonderful left foot, right foot. Didn't really have the heart for it, if I'm brutally honest with you. But and then it was eventually got the School of Excellence, which Brian Pop Robson used to take. That was once a week, and it was absolute. It was just like a dream. You know, it was like so surreal.
Were you single minded enough as a? Because we're led to believe that you have to be pretty single minded at a young age. To go on and achieve what you've achieved. I mean, you know, and it's not insignificant what you've achieved. You're an international football player and you played in the Premier League, which is as high as it gets. Do you feel like at the time you were aware of what was happening or were you just a kid enjoying yourself?
Well, the crazy thing about it is, right, so I'm talking about playing football in the streets there, but then when you start playing for your school and your Saturday and your Sunday league stuff...
Will you stand out better than everyone else?
Yeah, that's when you think, okay, you know, I'm better than these.
Okay.
I know I'm better than these, but I'm not going to say that because I'm 13 years old. You know, you'll end up fighting on the football field or something, but you know you've got something.
Yeah.
And I think everybody around you knows you've got something. And then it's the old, oh, I'm the best player at the school, or he's the best player at the school, etc. and everything. And then, you know, when you start to see the people watching you, you know you've got something, but you don't really know how good you are because, you know, if I go back to the Man United days, which was my first time as a, you know, signed for a football club, 13, 14 years old, getting on a train from Sunderland, you know, all the way down to Manchester. And then I got there. And it's like...
Because they decided to take you on, basically, and you would live in digs there and be part of the academy there.
Exactly.
And give some of our young listeners, give us an idea of some of the kids you were with when you were taken on by Man United.
Okay, so, I mean, I think the first one I've got to start with is Ryan Wilson, which I think everybody knows as Ryan Giggs.
Yeah.
But that was his name when he was a young kid.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as soon as I walked through the door at Man United, they were already talking about him.
Yeah.
It was just, I mean, absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Adrian Doherty, I think we've had a conversation about him before, haven't we? I mean, oh, what a player.
So Adrian Doherty is subject of a book called Forever Young by, I think, Ollie Kay. And he is a great lost talent who never... Sadly, had a tragic end to his life, his young life, but never quite fulfilled his potential as a footballer. And I think there's a tendency to kind of mythologise what people could have been, but some people would say that he was as good as Ryan Giggs at the time. Is that fair? Because you would have seen him firsthand every day, so you would say he was amazing.
Without a doubt. I mean, he was right wing and I was left back, so I knew how good he was.
Okay.
And people looked at Ryan. I mean, there was other people there. You know, there was a young kid called Raphael Burke, who, you know, another one they were talking about. Nick Barmby was there. Everybody. It was Manchester United at the time under Sir Alex Ferguson.
Yeah.
And so the best of the best. You know, it was 11 v 11. And if you weren't up for it, you got found out. So the first time I played, you know, I think Adrian was a year older than me, but he was actually involved in the game. But I played left back. And I remember Brian Kidd turned around to me and he said, right, where are you playing? I said, left back. He went, okay. So well, Ryan's going to play in front of you. He said, when you get the ball, just give it to him. He went, if there's three players around him, it doesn't matter. Just give him the ball.
Right.
He says, that's your job. So I said, like, okay.
Yeah.
And I like to get forward. I like to bomb forward and everything. But then I soon realised after probably 5 minutes of giving Ryan the ball two or three times,
I was
just like, you're gobsmacked. I was like, you can't do that at your age. You cannot do it at your age.
So you went from being brilliant at your school and by far the best player to seeing players around you going, my God, we've got some players here and this is a different level entirely.
Absolutely. And that's it. It's like, right, well, if that's how good I've got to be, I don't know if I'm good enough.
Right.
And that's the big problem that you've got, even at the age of 13 years old. And when I saw Ryan and I saw a few other players, I mean, David Beckham was in the year below me, but he was actually in my digs. But all, I was with that generation that came through and broke into the first team eventually. But it was just like, everything about it was just so special to me. Because, I mean, people think I'm a big Sunderland fan, which I am. You know, it's my hometown. And obviously that's where I played for a long, long time. And that was the stadium that I used to go to, was Roker Park, to watch them play. But my wall was Man United.
Right.
all over my wall was Brian Robson, Jesper Olsen, Arthur Alberston, Mark Hughes. That were the type of players that were on my wall.
Yeah.
So when I got the opportunity to go to Man United, it was like that was the dream for me.
Mm.
And although it only lasted like 2.5, 3 years, I got to the point where all these, even the year below me, I knew how good they were.
Mm.
And I was thinking, am I actually going to be good enough?
So if you had come along at a different time, you think you'd have stayed at United a bit longer?
If I could have stayed at Man United a little bit longer, knowing that that wasn't in front of me, Ryan Wilson or Ryan Giggs, who was playing left wing, because that was where I used to play, but they played me left back in this game, I probably would have stayed there.
So was it your decision to move on?
Yeah, it was my decision. So it was a massive decision at the time to say, do you know what? I might actually stay here. That was it was really, really big.
How did that manifest itself? You just decided one day that actually my future lies elsewhere, because to have the best chance of having a career, I'd need to be away from here. Or did someone come and give you some advice? Or how did it work at that time?
Well, I spoke to the people at Man United, you know, the coaches there, etc. And obviously Jim Hagan, who was a scout who I mentioned before, about, am I good enough? Do you think I'm actually going to make it at Manchester United? You know, I've got to try and believe in myself here. And these are the kind of questions I had to ask myself when I was 14, 15 years old.
It's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy young.
It was honestly, and then there was no agents at that time. You know, you didn't have an agent. I think there's a lot of young kids now who've got agents way too young for me. But I had to make these decisions. You know, you speak to your parents, right, what do you think? And they gave me the option, said, look, we'll leave it open for you, but why don't you go and try other clubs? And they helped me out with that. You know, I went to Ipswich, I went to Newcastle, you name it. I went everywhere. And the last one, funny enough, was Sunderland.
Hmm. How old are you at this point?
I was 15.
Okay.
And I kind of left school early. I never used to like school, so I never used to go. And I think the school knew that anyway. And they're saying, look, you know what you're going to be and everything. It's just find out where you want to be.
Did you have any doubt in your mind that you were going to be a professional football player somewhere?
By the age of 14, I think I knew somewhere or somebody was going to take me.
Yeah.
It was just a big decision of where I wanted to be. And then Sunderland called me up and said, look, you know, we've got a game this Saturday. Do you want to actually come and play for, you know, we used to be B team and A team.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and played for the B team and had a really good game. And there was like, Dennis Smith was there, was the manager at the time. And he was like, well, right, okay, we need to speak to him straight after the game.
Mm.
And that's exactly what they did. I mean, mum and dad were, funny enough, they were at the game. And so they took us in a little room and just said, look, we like what we see. We actually want to sign you on.
Mm.
And I was, this is another crazy thing. I was closer to signing for Newcastle.
Right.
Because at that age, they offered me a better contract than what Sunderland did.
Right.
They offered me, because this is what they used to do in those days. So it was a 2-year apprenticeship and then a 2-year pro.
Mm.
But some clubs did it and some other clubs didn't it. But they also offered me a figure on top of that as well.
Mm.
And being from where I was from at the time, you know, we didn't really have nothing.
Yeah.
And it was a big figure.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe could have even paid off my parents' mortgage.
Mm.
So I said to like my parents at the time, I was like, what should I do? I don't really want to play for Newcastle.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's so crazy.
And you were how old at this time? 16 years old?
15.
15
still. I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
And then I'd had the trial at Sunderland and they came back and only offered me a 2-year apprenticeship.
Mm.
And I said, well, look, I have to tell you, this is what Newcastle have offered me.
Mm.
And I made the bold decision of, and this is, again, this is crazy. And I just went, I said, you know what? I want to actually prove that I deserve a professional contract.
Mm.
I said, so I'm going to take the 2-year apprenticeship.
Mm.
So I was safe for 4 years. I knew what I was going to be doing if I'd signed for Newcastle. I knew what signing on fee I was going to be having.
Mm.
And I knew what I'd be earning every single week, which was 36 quid or something like that. But at the time, you know, it was absolutely incredible. And then I signed for Sunderland. I said, right, okay, I'm going to do the 2 years apprenticeship. And I knew as soon as I started, I got off to a really good start. I knew how fit I was anyway. You know, when we do pre-season, all the running, then the games obviously came around and you're playing certain players, et cetera, every other week. And I just hit it off.
Are you training with the first team at this point?
No, I wasn't. It took me a year. I trained, obviously, with the youth team and then I got into my second year of my apprenticeship. And I would probably say the second half of that second year, then the manager used to say, right, you need to come and train with the first team. And it was for little five-a-sides. And there was so much envy and jealousy and everything where, you know, 50-50 tackles, you know, they wouldn't care it was me. You know, being a young lad and everything, they'd go right through you. It was just so physical. I was like, I'm not ready for this. You know, I'm a slight lad anyway.
Mm.
But I had a little bit of ability and a little bit of a pace where I could get away from people, you know, in little short-sided games and stuff like that. And you go, right, if this is what it's all about, I've got to toughen up. And you've got to do it in an instant. Mm. If you start to show fear in front of somebody who's maybe in your position, not that you're going to play, you know, you're still 16 years old, they've won. They've beat you.
Mm.
And if you show the fear to the manager or the coaches, that, you know, you're limping away from a challenge or you stay on the ground and you start moaning and rolling around, Evan, forget it. In those days, when I was playing, when I was coming through, that's what it was all about. The physicality was more than the ability, if you like.
How much, if you could break it down, because I've spoken to Matt Taylor, who I know you know as part of this series, and I've also spoken to some other players who you would term as a real kind of talented players. I remember speaking to Dimitar Berbatov, and he said, oh, he didn't really have to work that hard to be a professional footballer because of his ability. But Matt Taylor said, really, it was, in his opinion, 85% hard work. I mean, where do you come down on that, in that argument? For you, was it more about hard work or more about the talent you were born
no,
with?
No, I have to agree. I think, you know, I wouldn't give it a percentage about hard work, but I think, you know, because before you sign for somebody, you know the ability's there. This is why you got the opportunity in the first place. So I think when you get there, what the culture shock is, going from playing in the street with your mates to then training every single day professionally, you know, massages, looking after yourself properly, then getting to a Saturday and still wanting to be the best. But that hard work, you cannot do it without the hard work.
Did you have to sacrifice going out with your pals and all that kind of thing?
Yeah.
And you were happy to do that?
Yeah, that didn't bother me, to be honest with you. I mean, I was still living at home, so it was always the same mates. You know, if I wanted to go and knock around the streets like we used to do after I'd finished training and have a couple of hours before, you know, I went back to home at, say, 9, 10 o'clock. But then I went home and I was in bed. If there was a football match on, I would have watched it. You know, again, in them days, there wasn't too many football matches.
You were crazy about football?
Yeah, I loved it. You know,
and you were a sensible boy at that time, at that age?
School-wise, no. I said before, I didn't enjoy school at all. You know, I'd walk to school with a ball.
Right.
And, you know, you keep ups all the way to school if you possibly can. Then you'd put it away, and then you'd do your lessons. And then I'd pick the ball up and then I'd do exactly the same on the way home. And that was every single day. You saw a garage, you were playing against a garage.
Right.
You've seen a wall. That was it. If you had a ball, I was happy. And most of my mates, you know, they'd still join in and enjoy it. But, like, I could tell, you know, I said before, you know, there was two or three people. Clive Mendonca went to my school. David Rush, who played for Sunderland, went to my school.
A bit on Clive Mendonca later, I expect.
I thought there might be, yeah.
Yeah.
But why
do you think, it's a bit of an abstract question, but I mean, why do you think you were born good at football? I mean, are your parents particularly sporty, or is there any footballers in the family or anything like that?
My dad was decent, apparently.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it was more down to the background with my dad. You know, difficult background. So nothing really came from that, to be honest with you. And then my brother, who's, 3 years older than me, he had the opportunity to go to Ipswich.
Right.
He was quick. He was a right winger. So more so watching him and then playing football in the streets and on the football fields, if you could get on them in the school fields, and then watching what he was doing. 3 years older than me, and going, right, okay, if he can do that, then I've got to learn something, or I've got to do something better myself.
But he didn't have a career.
No.
His son's a player, is he? Your nephew's a player, isn't he?
No, my nephew's a player.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
Both of my nephews. Obviously.
Okay.
But he's been around. You know, he's at Hartlepool and he's had a couple of non-league.
So you just think you're just born with it and that's that?
Yeah, but I mean, that was it. You know, I woke up on my birthday morning, there was a ball wrapped up. I woke up on Christmas morning, there was a ball wrapped up. It was basically all we had. So you made the most of it.
So you're quite single-minded with that.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I mean, I like other sports. You know, if anything on the television, I would watch the tennis. You know, I'd watch whatever else was on there. But the main priority was just football, if I could see it.
And you broke into the first team at Sunderland pretty early on as well, right? 18, just 18?
Just 18, yeah.
92, 93?
Yeah.
And what do you remember of your debut for your hometown club? Must have been a pretty big deal.
Incredible.
Do you actually remember it?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. I'd travelled away. A couple of weeks before it, we played Bristol Rovers, and I travelled away, and I thought, I've got half a chance of getting involved here. You know, you start to get a little bit giddy and a little bit nervous, and the game was away from home, and it was a bit of a wet and windy day. Played them in late afternoon. We'd stayed down. We'd had a couple of games. I think we actually played Bristol City as well.
Right.
That was why we stayed down. So I'd been a part of the squad. I was on the bus. That was the first time it had ever happened to me. And then 2 weeks later, I think Dennis Smith had actually got the sack.
Right.
And Malcolm Crosby took over as caretaker manager. And we played Derby County away. And again, got named in the squad, travelled down in the squad. Nobody said anything to me.
Right.
You know, he sat on the coach and I'm making the teas. You know, somebody asked me to make a cup of tea and I'm sat at the front. I wasn't really getting involved in any of the conversations.
You're the only one of your age group who got picked.
Oh, yeah. At the time. But then eventually, you know, we had Craig Russell who came through, and then Martin Smith, who broke in, I think, you know, the season after me or late in that season. So the three of us were really good pals anyway.
Mm.
So it was really good to, you know, to get them on the coach and travel away. But it was Derby County away, which we won 1-0.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting my first pay packet in this little brown envelope. And mine at the time was 76 quid or something. I used to get a little bit more than everybody else. And then I got my first pay, which was we won against Derby. I came on at half time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we played at Southend. At half time, I came on again. We won 1-0. And then my home debut was against Barnsley. Mm-hmm. And I scored after a minute mm-hmm. or a minute and 20 seconds or something like mm-hmm. that with my right foot. And I got the pay packet. And I cannot remember how much was in it, but let's just, for instance, say like 600-700 quid.
Right.
And you know when you get something and you think, well, that's a bit heavier than normal.
Yeah.
And then me being a, you know, a little tow rag and having nothing, being grown up, you know, the same tracksuit for the, 5 years or something like that, you know, the same trainers, etc. I'm thinking in the back of my mind, have they given me somebody else's? Right. Should I say something?
Yeah.
But me going in my head, you know, the devil on the other shoulder going, don't say a word.
Keep it.
Just put it in your pocket and go home.
Yeah.
And it was unreal. And I took it home and I was like, Mom, look what I've got. I went, I don't know if it's mine or not, but... Like they've gave it me and it's got my name on the envelope.
Yeah.
It was like...
It's mad.
I was like, wow.
It's a world away from a kid of that age now playing football at the top level, yeah?
It was amazing. I mean, let's say 500 quid or something like that, right? It's probably like 50 grand now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
So as a kid at that age playing for your hometown team, you're saying you had absolutely no, other than your family, of course, you had no real sort of support network around you in the club. Like, you're going to be making your debut. We understand you're going to feel very nervous. This is important to you. It's a big deal. Yep. But that's strange because it's in their interest for you to make a success of this as well, right?
I think what they try and do is turn you into a man.
Right.
Straight away.
And what do you think about that, looking back on it now?
Well, because that's what I was brought up with. I didn't mind it. You know, that was the way it was. Mm. You know, I've seen younger players get their opportunity, you know, maybe a couple of years older than me. And the same was happened to them. You know, I wasn't allowed in the first team dressing room unless I got invited in there.
Mm.
It was reserves, and then I had to get into reserves to actually change with the reserve team.
Mm.
Or it was, you know, you're getting changed with the youth team.
Mm.
And then it was still clean your boots, still do your jobs around we got changed at Roker Park, and we used to travel to the training ground in a little minibus.
Right.
Everything was just proper old school, but because that was what I'd been brought up with.
You didn't know any different, really.
Yeah, exactly, So, you know, you look at like the modern day now, and those things that you just mentioned before, you know, psychologists, you know, they would tell you 2 days before you're in the first team, look, this is what you've got to expect. Make sure you're prepared.
Do you think you would have benefited from that?
Some of it, yes. But I think some of it, no. Because I think you can overkill the brain. I think if you tell somebody if I'd have been told 2 or 3 days before I was making my debut, or I was going to be on the bench, I wouldn't have slept for 3 days.
Yeah.
I honestly wouldn't have, you know, because like it's your dream to make your debut.
Yeah.
And it's this, I mean, people say playing for England or, you know, moving to a great club or winning a trophy and everything. I probably bet that all youngsters who make their debut, and if you say, what's your dream as a kid?
Mm.
Mine was making my debut.
Mm.
You know, not winning the championship to jump into the Premier League or playing for England, which are special things.
Yeah, yeah.
But making your debut, there's no other feeling like it.
And when you were told at half time in the dressing room you were coming on for the second half?
Nervous as hell.
Can you remember that, being told that?
Yeah, and nervous as hell.
You just tried to keep a straight face and try and just focus. Yeah.
And the weird thing is, and I don't know if this is more for forward players or not, maybe they can just go out and play with a little bit of freedom, but as a defender, you know, we're hanging on to a one-goal lead. We're playing Derby County, a really good side. And I'm thinking, I've got to keep a clean sheet here.
Who are you up against on the right?
That is a good... It might have been Pembridge, actually.
Mark Pembridge?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know he used to drift left and right, but it might actually have been him.
What did you think of the level? Was it like, God, this is mad?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, they're all men. You know, I said before, I'm quite slight. You know, I've got no weight, and I never really have. You know, I'm still the same weight now. I'm 44 than I was when I was 17.
Yeah.
So, you know, what you see is what you get.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking like, well, this Pembridge, you know, I don't know what he weighs, but he's a big, thick-set lad, and he's running at me, and I'm thinking, don't make a mistake.
Yeah.
But what's good is, you know, the experienced players. I mean, we had, then Kevin Ball was in the squad at the time. I think, I'm not too sure if Terry Butcher actually played in that game. I think he might have done, to be honest with you. But we had people like that. Just they basically said to me, as I'm going onto the pitch, you've got here because you're good enough.
So they were actually very helpful. They weren't fear for their own places or anything like that. They were very helpful.
No,
for
they
you.
Were brilliant. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think, you know, if you did make a mistake or you give the ball away, you know, it wasn't like, you know, the kick up the backside that maybe you would have got, you know, 2 years into your career.
Hmm.
You know, it was like unlucky next time, you know, when it comes to you, blah, blah. And they helped out like nobody's business.
Hmm.
I got through 40 minutes. I mean, I blinked and it was finished.
Right.
So to try and say, do you remember the 45 minutes?
Hmm.
Absolutely not.
No.
But I remember coming on for half time. Being in that dressing room and then the manager saying to me, right, get yourself stripped and ready. And that's the moment where you go, oh my God, am I ready for this? Am I not ready for this?
Hmm.
Well, only time's going
to
tell.
When you're about I walk to find out. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. You know, it's like, you're in the lion's den, to be honest with you. And then the supporters there. And because you're a young lad.
The supporters love the fact that you're an academy player
exactly,
and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So they see you come out and every time you did something well, whether it was a tackle, a header or something where you played a ball down the line, etc., there was a massive cheer and I could hear it.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's relaxed me like you would not believe.
Have you always been a player that's been able, were you always a player who would pick up on the crowd? Because a lot of players zone it out, don't they, and try not to concern themselves.
When you're younger, I think, of course, you hear the cheers.
Yeah.
The jeers don't really come as much because, like I said before, they give you a little bit of leeway.
Mm.
But I think when you get to the age of 19, 20, 21, when you're established, you start making mistakes. Yes, you hear a little jeer here, there, and then when you're picking the ball up to take a throw in or a corner or something, and if you're having a bad game, they let you know about it.
Yeah.
And then again, you've got to be ready for it. How do I react to that? Do I turn around or do I give them it back? Or do I just keep concentrating on what I'm doing?
What's the worst you've experienced? Millwall?
The old den.
Yeah.
Coins getting thrown. Because I was sub.
Yeah.
Coins getting thrown at me. swear words like, nobody's business.
Right.
That was pretty frightening.
And you were young at the time.
Yeah, I was, 18, I think, 17, 18 or 19. And that was scary because as you come out the tunnel, it was caged.
Yeah.
So all the fans are pulling it and banging against it. And obviously, well, I don't know if they were spitting. I didn't really look, to be honest with you. It was head down and getting through it.
Yeah.
That was really bad. But I also played at Cardiff's old ground. Mm. I think I
Linnean
was at,
Park.
Yeah. I think I was at Leeds. Maybe Wolves, it was one of the two I was at, and you're talking 9, 10, 11, 12 year olds shouting things that I've never heard in my life.
Yeah,
you know, they might have come out of my mouth, you know, when I was 17, 18, 19, but like this, and I'm like, oh my God.
So it does affect you then?
Yeah, individually, you know, and I think being a fullback or a left winger, which I was for obviously most of my career, you know, because I'm taking throw-ins and corners, that you get it more so then. If I'm playing the game, didn't affect me whatsoever. You know, you'd hear a big cheer if I'm doing an overlapping run, which was like my game. When me and Alan Johnson are left-hand side at Sunderland. No, it just happened. We didn't work on it, but it just clicked. But you could hear a massive cheer because they knew something was coming. So yeah, not an individual, but as a crowd, you knew when they were up for it.
And so fast forward a couple of years or a few years and you were able to, well, you were a regular starter by the sort of mid-90s and you played in the left as Sunderland won Division 1 and got promoted into the Premier League. We talked a bit about the step up in standard to make your debut. Can you remember stepping up into the Premier League and thinking, well, this is a different level entirely?
Yeah, without a doubt.
Hmm.
I mean, the debut and I'm sure it was that year when we played against Nottingham Forest and I scored the first goal ever in the Premier League for a Sunderland player.
Hmm.
So I'm in the record books for forever.
Can't take that away from you, mate.
Take that away from me. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we won the game, so that was like, right, okay. I'll have some more of this. You know, you're going to play at Nottingham Forest, and then obviously, you're like, you know, you're traveling around the country at Old Trafford, etc.
Did it feel much faster?
Yeah, but the quality was just so much different. You know, you felt. This sounds crazy, but you get more time in the Premier League.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because the quality, you've got to think quicker. You know,
did you feel out of place or did you feel like you could do it?
No, I was loving it. And every step you take higher and higher, the better teams that you played against, you know, you want to raise your game. And then you don't want to get yourself in that comfort zone. You always want to keep improving. And of course you have lulls, you know, you have ups and downs and everything, you know, you go through a period where you maybe don't win for 7 or 8 games. And then your confidence, you know, is so low. Every time the ball comes to you, you can't wait to get rid of it.
And then Does that really even affect the top players?
Without a doubt. You've got to overcome it like nobody's business. And this is why I think, you know, some people always turn around and say, oh, yeah, he's not had the best of games, but he worked his socks off.
Mm.
That's the only way to get through it. You've got to get through that brick wall.
What kind of techniques would you use to try and get your confidence back? Or is it just you have to just wait and ride it out and get something positive happening and then you're away again?
You wait for something good to happen. And if it happens, then it's like, right, okay, I can do something else now.
Do you think even the very best players are affected by that?
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if you look at players now, you know, we probably have a conversation off air, if you like, and go, wow, what a top player he is. But he had 5 or 6 games in January and he was absolutely hopeless. And that's the reason why, you know, it's like a knock-on effect. You have one poor game. The next one's a poor game after that. Then you, like a centre forward, for instance, if you haven't scored for 3 or 4 games, you're a bad player. Or you thinking to yourself, oh my goodness, I've not scored here for 4 games. I've got to make sure I've got a score today. And then you try that little bit harder.
Did you read the reports when you were having a bad game? Did you read the newspaper?
No.
Never?
No, honestly, I didn't like to
what
do it.
What about if you knew you played well? You scored a goal
every single week, because you knew, like, you knew when you were looking in the paper, you knew it was going to be a 7 or an 8. Because, well, that's the way they marked it. I think they still do it now, but you don't really see it as much, to be honest. But it was the local papers, and it was like, right, I've played well today. I know I have. I've got 7 or 8, or it's man of the match.
I think people definitely listening will think it interesting that top players care about that.
Isn't it mad? You know, when you
because it's some guy, it's some probably some in your eyes, it'll be some overweight old guy who's smoking 20 a day and thinks he's got a deadline, so he's got to put it in as quick as he can. But to players, they really did worry about it.
Oh,
would there be talk about it in the dressing room?
Well, if I can, leapfrog for another 15 years forward in my career, Robbie Savage, when I was at Blackburn, would come into work, and we were really close with the local guy who used to put the marks into the papers.
Right.
Robbie Savage would collar him after every home game on a Saturday, played well, average or great, and go, you make sure I don't get less than a 7 or 8, or none of them players in that dressing room are going to talk to you and give you any interviews. And I'm definitely not going to. And that was what it was like. It was like,
I don't think many people listening, Mickey, will be surprised to hear that Robbie was capable of that.
Oh, no, I love him to bits.
I know you do.
I hated him before he became a teammate. I couldn't stand him.
No.
But I don't know what it was. We just had this clash with our personalities, where we just rubbed each other the right way.
But he's probably the kind of guy you'd want in your dressing room.
He's amazing. Yeah. Absolutely amazing.
Let's take a quick break, and after we come back, we'll talk a bit more about your career, Mickey.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome back to this episode of Ramble Meets with Mickey Gray, great footballer and a great man. I hope I won't embarrass you by saying that, mate. we left it earlier talking a bit about Robbie Savage, but mostly talking about you playing in the Premier League. Now, of course, we know that Sunderland's stay in the Premier League on that occasion didn't last an awful long time. And as a kid from the area, and how badly did it affect you when you guys were relegated? Because one of the things I found surprising moving into working with players and ex-players and stuff, it's just how much they do actually care. Because if you read the newspapers and you read the media, and you would be forgiven for thinking that players, it's not bothered, they're not bothered, it's just a job for them. And the occasional thing like Alan Smith when Leeds got relegated. But every single person I've met who's played the game genuinely does care. So for you, presumably it was a huge, huge blow to be relegated.
I was gutted. I was absolutely gutted. I think we knew what type of season it was going to be. But the clever thing with managers is, you know, they try and distract you from what's in front of you. And, as I mentioned, you know, you can go 5 or 6 games in the Premier League without having a point. And then it's up to the manager to work his magic and the coaches around you to keep the place really happy. You know, right, shall I bring them into training today, or should I take them paintballing, or should I take them go-karting, or shall I just take them on a night out? Because that's what we used to do. And we got to the end of the season. I think we played at Wimbledon. Well, I think that was the last game.
This is 96-97, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we played Wimbledon, and we knew we needed to win. And they'd got an early goal. What was the centre-forward, left-footed guy? I can't remember his name. It was Gale.
Marcus Gale.
Yeah, I think he scored the goal. Can't remember what the score was when we finished. I know we didn't obviously get enough, what we needed, whether it was a draw or a win. And you basically, because it hadn't happened to me before, it was like, wow, like what happens now?
Probably the first real disappointment in your career, right?
Yeah, I mean, you get left out a couple of times, but you're a young lad. But
generally, you're on an upward trajectory to that
absolutely,
point.
Absolutely, yeah. But I just had this feeling, and this is a crazy thing to say, but that squad of players that we had, I kind of knew we weren't good enough.
Do you know, maybe you don't know this, but the top scorer for Sunderland that season in the Premier League?
Me.
And that's Craig Russell and Paul Stewart.
Four. Yeah.
4 goals. The following season, Kevin Phillips, 29 league goals. Wow. 4 goals. I thought it was wrong when I first saw that. It's so few.
Yeah.
And you got 40 points.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's why we knew we had a chance on the final day.
Mm.
So we'd went there, and I mean,
You were really upset, were you?
I was absolutely devastated.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we turned up and we actually, you know, we'd done everything right, as you do. And it was like, right, it's all down to this one game. Come out the dressing room, and it might as well have been Roker Park, the stadium alight. I mean, there was just thousands of Sunderland supporters in there. How they got in, I don't know. How many tickets they gave them. It was like a home game.
Right.
It was pretty scary. So you're obviously thinking to yourself, right, okay, I don't want to let myself down. I don't want to let teammates down, but this lot, can't let them down.
No, you got to do it, yeah.
And it was just uproar throughout the whole of the game.
Did you have a good game?
Do you know what? I don't actually know. It was a game that I wasn't bothered if I did or I didn't.
Right,
I just wanted to
win. Yeah, yeah. Were you satisfied that everyone else in the team wanted to win enough?
Yeah, I think when you get to that position, I mean, said, you know, that season was always going to be a hard one. You know, trying to establish yourself in the Premier League is difficult anyway. But we knew we had a good manager in charge. You know, he kept everything bubbly. You know, did we get up a season too early? I know a lot of people have said that. We probably did, but, you know, who cares?
No,
we wanted,
you're not going to turn it down,
are you? Absolutely, yeah. So, I think everybody give everything throughout the whole of that season. We might have had injuries throughout, you know, as other teams did. You know, they balance themselves out. But getting to the last day of the season and knowing that you still had a chance.
Yeah. And you'd have taken that at the start, given the games at Wimbledon away. Yeah, exactly.
Without a doubt. Yeah. You say to yourself, right, everything on the line. That's it. I'm not coming off this pitch if I'm not crawling. I'm giving everything that I've got.
Yeah.
And then you get the end of the game and obviously you're disappointed and you're just standing around, to be honest with you. And then it's like, you know, you applaud the supporters and thanking them for the season, for supporting you throughout. And then it's back to the dressing room. And it was just, I suppose, a lot of every player will say this, who, you know, has disappointments. You know, it's just silent. And you're in there, everybody's heads down, you know, you see people loosening the laces, taking their boots off and shin pads. And then it's you're basically waiting for your coach or your manager just to say something to trigger it off. Right, where did it all go wrong? Look, we might have been able to do something at the tourney a little bit better, so I'll take the blame for that. But you've got to look at yourselves, guys. You know, did you do enough?
Is that what he said? Good enough?
I think it was along them lines. Yeah. I mean, Pete Reid was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. For my career, not just for mine, you know, for a lot of players at Sunderland. I mean, you mentioned Kevin Phillips before. Those type of players, he was amazing.
Just give you belief, give you confidence.
Yeah, but it was more than that. You know, it was away from the football. You know, you could pick the phone up. What are you doing? Right, right. I'm going to get all the lads in tomorrow. We're going to go for a meal together. Everybody's coming. If you don't come, you're getting fined and everything. But a laugh and a joke around training, Mondays, Tuesdays.
Yeah.
Then the serious business was Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, unless you had a day off. And then match days, he just said the right thing every week.
Right.
And keep going back to the old adage, but you wanted to run through brick walls for him.
What's the coach like back up to Sunderland after that kind of relegation?
Well, funny enough, we had to stay off at a supporters club.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Who planned that? That's a terrible bit of planning.
I know. Well, they have a London supporters branch, and we used to do it, you know, where they would play Tottenham or any time we were down in London.
All of you would go?
Yeah, that was the coach. So we'd go from whichever ground we were playing at, you'd go to the supporters branch, you'd spend an hour, a couple of hours with him, you know, you'd have a drink with him, whether you'd, again, won, lost, or draw, and it was like, oh, I'm really sorry, you know.
Did you enjoy that kind of thing?
Yeah, because I think what you forget is, you know, when you come out of the North East, there's other places where there's people support Sunderland.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pretty compact place. It's a goldfish bowl.
Yeah.
And especially when you live there and you're being brought up there, you pretty much know everybody, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So when you come out and you see London and you see different supporters and everything, it just gives something back to them.
Yeah.
And I think the appreciation's there from both sides. Mm. You know, the manager would go up and do his speech, and our captain, probably Kevin Ball at the time, would probably have a few words. And another. And it was a couple of pints back on the coach, and then it was a journey home. A few more beers on the bus.
It must have been like a morgue after that game.
It was awful. Yeah, but I think that's where the great managers that you work under will turn around to you and, you know, they'll get in the coach and they'll go, listen, lads, thanks for the effort you've given me all season. I know it wasn't enough, unfortunately, but right, there's a crate of beer. Get it at the back. Have a great time. Have a lovely summer. But make sure you're ready when you come back pre-season. I don't want anybody coming back overweight, which used to happen in those days.
Yeah. Did it used to happen? It obviously never happened to you, but would it have happened quite a lot that you can remember?
Yeah, we would have 5, 6, 7, maybe more than that, actually. They'd all come back overweight.
Overweight by like an every stone, person standards
stone,
or by an athlete?
A stone overweight.
Bloody hell.
We'd have players
in 3 months
overweight.
Or 2 months.
Yeah. Well, one of the players, I mean, I'm not pointing him out here, but Don Goodman was one. You know, as soon as the season finished, he used to switch off from football.
Right.
And he'd come back to training and use pre-season to get it all off again.
But you'd always lived a life, would you?
I'd always have a 2 week holiday.
Yeah.
But then I'd come back and it was the same thing. I'd be in the streets with my mate.
Right.
Having a laugh and a joke, and then I'd go out and do what I wanted to do, but then live your life, whatever you wanted to do. But I used to train. Yeah. So when I was off on pre-season, it was that 2 weeks off, then you'd go back and I'd start running the streets, and then you'd go on a football field and do the different runs, the sprints, etc., what you needed to do. But still knowing that, I didn't want to be 100% fit going through the door on the first day of pre-season, because you've got to get better through pre-season. So right. I'd leave it a little bit. I wouldn't quite hit 100%. You know, I'd try and get myself up to 80%, for instance, and then make up the other 20% when I got into the training ground. But there was a lot of lads didn't do that. And the more that I played, the further down the line you went, they realised that they got left behind.
Right.
The ones who came back, you know, a stone heavier, you know, the body fat went from, well, mine was like between 8 and 11 or something like that. You know, the lads were coming back and it was 16 and 18%. And like to an average guy in the street, you know, if you did a body fat test, you know, you're talking, they're probably 20, 24, or maybe you'd get guys from the street will be 16. So it was like a guy off the street bringing him in and going, he's got to lose 6% of body fat here in the space of 4 weeks.
Do you think it still happens now, that kind of thing?
No, I don't. You get programs, you get regimes, and I think most of the players stick to it now because the game.
You never see like an overweight player at all now.
Well,
do you?
I mean, you see
even at a lower level, you don't see it.
No, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that, you know, these players know that if they leave it too long, and they come back to pre-season and they're not right, because, you know, there's blood tests, there's body tests, there's fat tests, you know, there's heart monitors, there's everything. There's no hiding place. There just isn't. And that's why I said to you before, you know, I like some of it, but I don't like other parts of it. You know, I think there's too many stats. I think, you know, there's this Prozone stuff that came out when I was playing. I think you can read too much into that. I think it's great for certain bits of information. You know, I was talking to you about, you know, 360 surround now that they've got. You know, you actually put the goggles on and you look around and see how you've played throughout the 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, that's sometimes too much
for
me.
Full on that.
Yeah, and that's every week, and it sometimes can be twice a week because you play two games. If you've made mistakes and you keep watching it back, it's like, well, actually, we need to see this.
Living a nightmare.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. But speaking of living a nightmare, I want to talk about the following season to the relegation from the Premier League, Mickey, because it's that, like it or not, and I presume you probably don't like it, that 98 playoff final is synonymous with you and with Clive Mendonca for his hat-trick. And really, what was a crazy playoff final? I mean, first of all, give us a bit of a flavour of what it was like to play in a game that had such high stakes, that was such a crazy affair.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's a build-up throughout the season, and we actually had a chance to finish in the top two spots. I think it came down to the last two or three games, and we got pipped for it. We'd made a couple of mistakes, so we obviously dropped down into the playoffs. There was a bit of disappointment with that, first and foremost. And then, obviously, you look at where you finish in the playoff positions, and we knew that we got Sheffield United. I didn't actually play in the first game. I was suspended. I got sent off at West Bromwich Albion, I think it was.
What was that for?
Kicked someone up the backside.
Was it a fair red?
Probably, yeah.
What would the 44-year-old Mickey Gray say to the kid? No.
You idiot.
Would you?
No, I'll do it again, probably. yeah, so I kind of missed it, and I thought, you know, if we don't get through to the playoffs, I'm suspended for the beginning of next season, which I didn't want. But it worked out pretty well where I missed the last day of the season and then I missed the Sheffield United away game. Yeah. Then we took them back to the Stadium of Light. Best atmosphere as a Sunderland player I've ever played in. Ever.
Right.
It was just incredible. And then, you know, as you got through that, we did what we had to do, and then it was pretty much we got ourselves to Wembley. But I think our problem was sometimes, and I look back and thought about it a few times, that it was more of an occasion for us.
Right.
So driving up to Wembley Way, you know, going down to the hotel the day before, you know, we'd picked our suits out, you know, we were all picking out sunglasses and things like that.
Right.
And now thinking back, I'm like, what are we doing?
It's kind of a bit like when the Liverpool team got to the FA Cup final with the white suits.
It wasn't white suits, but it was getting measured up for the suits and the shirt and tie.
Can I just say, if you were in that squad, you definitely would have been in the white suit. You'd have been loving that, wouldn't you? You'd have been loving that.
I'd have loved that, yeah. I'd still be wearing it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was it. I truly believe, you know, we actually, the build-up, the occasion, maybe took its toll on us.
Right.
To be honest with you.
So you think that can be mentally kind of exhausting?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But you also said about the game, because it finished 4-4, and I think I'm right in saying Sunderland went 2-1 ahead, and then they kept pegging you back. And you said, I've seen a bit of footage of you where you say, every time we got our nose in front and we thought, right, we just got to keep them out now, they kept coming. You thought you'd finished them, but they kept coming back and kept coming back.
Yeah.
And that must have been pretty, like, mentally tough to deal with that.
Well, it was a nightmare.
It was a hot day as well, wasn't it?
It was a hot day, and our kits that day, I don't know where they came from. We had this gold kit, but it was double-layered.
Right.
So you could actually turn it inside out and use it. I can't remember what the colour was on the inside.
So it was twice as hot as it would have been.
Yeah, it was really heavy. So you can imagine, I mean, me, it was double my weight trying to run up and down the wing. But yeah, it was 120 degrees it was pitch side that day.
Do you think sincerely that kit had an effect on it?
Well, I can't say that, can I? Because I think it's went down as one of the best games ever to be played at the old Wembley.
Yeah.
You know, I must admit, at the end of the game, I know I was out on my feet, and I think a lot of the other players were as well.
But you'd expect that anyway, of such a game.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, obviously going into extra time and stuff like that. Mm. But the way the game panned out, and I think you've explained it pretty well, you know, the way the games, the goals went in. Even when Nicky Summerby scored in, I think it was out of time, Nicky's won, and that made it 4-3. Then again, we're like, that's it. We've done it. All we have to do now is just keep them out. You know, you get the goal before 90 minutes. We think, right, okay, that's the winner. Then they get an equaliser. I mean, Clyburn Duncan just had the game of his life, didn't he? I mean, it was just incredible.
A couple of those goals in particular were unreal.
Some of his first touches on two of the goals.
The hat-trick one where the ball comes across and he kills it dead and spins. Yeah. That was a ridiculous goal.
Amazing. Because we're thinking, right, he's going to shoot now. And then he flicks it again and then he sticks it in the bottom corner. Yeah. And I was like, God, every time this guy has a shot, it's going in the back of the net. It was one of them days for him. I mean, he probably his best game of the game that he's ever played.
Yeah.
But, so extra time comes, and then again, we both score. I mean, Richard Rufus, first ever goal for Charlton. You know, Lionel Perez, who was known for it, you know, coming off his line, he just got absolutely nowhere near it. Should have stayed on his line, and it's thank you very much to catch it. And then
what did you make of him as a keeper anyway?
Well, he should have used his goalie gloves on his feet. He was better with his feet than his hands.
Okay. And were some of the players not having him then?
Oh, no, we didn't have him. We knew there was a mistake in him. I mean, he pulled off some incredible saves in certain games, no doubt about that. You know, he's very athletic. But I think for someone to rely on every week consistently, he wasn't the answer for us.
No, okay.
Yeah, absolutely not.
So it goes to penalties. Mm. And give us a flavour of what the sort of group's like. What's the atmosphere like when you know this is going to happen? Because I've heard players in the past say, no, I just don't want it to be me. I don't want it to be me to let it down. And is there a difference between certain types of players, the ones who, like yourself, who we'll come onto in a minute, will step up and take responsibility? Is there a line to be drawn between those types of players, do you think? Or is it just who feels better on the day?
Well, I don't know about responsibility for me, but I'll get to that in a sec. But I think what happens is, obviously, at the end of the game, I mean, we've got Kevin Phillips, who's been taken off. We've got Lee Clark, who's been taken off. I think Darren Holloway was the other one who got took off, and Chris Macon came on for him. I mean, you're looking around, you get it yourself into a huddle, and I think Peter Reid's obviously got us round and say, how would you feel and everything? How are you feeling? Have you got any energy left and everything? Do you want to take a penalty? Well, my background, being from Sunderland, being a local boy, you know, I'd been there for a long time, you know, up until that point. Did I want to take one? Absolutely not. You know, he said, do you want to take a penalty? And
are you scared to say no?
No, I said no.
Okay.
I said no. I didn't want to take one. Mm. We'd taken them in training 2 or 3 days before at the Stadium of Light, and I was putting them in the top corner, the right hand, top left hand corner, bottom corner. Hardly missed, if I missed at all. Mm. And I remember Peter Reid come up to me. He walked up as I was going to the penalty spot, and he said, it's easy now, isn't it? I went, it's a piece of cake, Gaffy. He said, you wait till there's 80,000 people in this stadium. He said, let's see how you feel then. Mm. And it stuck with me. Mm. And I was like, right, okay.
Yeah.
And I got into the stadium, and it was that feeling, you know, because you're not just looking in a certain area. The manager's talking to you, but you're having a look around, see what's going on.
Sure.
And it was like, there actually is 80,000 people or more in this stadium. Mm. I've got to pick that ball up and walk to the penalty spot. Do I want to do it? No.
How did it come from you saying no to, I know it went to sudden death, and then someone, a sixth player, had to step up and take it. How did it go? How did it fall upon you? Because you've made a comment I've seen saying that Danny Dicchio was there, and he's a striker, but he had taken his boots off. Mm. How did you feel about that then? How do you feel about that now?
Well, look, I mean, the first five penalties that we named them, I mean, off the top of my head, I mean, Alex Ray, Niall Quinn, Nicky Summerby, Chris Macon, and Kevin Ball. I think that was our five.
Right.
And then it was Niall Quinn. Mm. So Niall Quinn was
looking around.
So he wasn't
in the original five?
No, exactly, okay. So Niall was in the centre circle and went, right, lads, anybody want to take one? And we're like, no, don't really want to take one. Because you think you're going to be over after five. Mm. That's the mindset. Mm. Just please get it over with. Mm. Win or lose, after five. Mm. So they get to six and Quinny's there and Quinny's went, right, okay. So he's went up to the penalty spot. He's took his penalty. He stuck it away. Then Charlton have done exactly the same. Well, they went before us. I can't remember how it worked. I think obviously they were leading all the time, weren't they?
Yeah, they were first, I think.
Yeah. And then I've looked around because, and you're right to mention that, you know, Danny Dicchio, he was in the centre circle and there was him, I think it was Jordy Craddock and Darren Williams.
Alan Johnston took the other one for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Alan Johnston took another one. Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
So I'm looking around thinking, right, who's left? So I turned around and I said, right, Deitch, centre forward. I said, go on. I said, I'll go after you. He was like, well, I can't use the words on here, but it was like, absolutely no chance. And he turned around, he sat down and his boots were alongside him. He had them off his feet.
What do you think about that now?
Well, if I tell you that, we had a pre-season game and we went back after that season and it was in Le Tournoir, I think we were. Le Touquet, that's where we were, Le Touquet.
Right. Okay.
First game we played, it was a little group thing we were playing in. The first game we played in, we drew 0-0. 89th minute, we got a penalty and he took it.
pre-season, he likes it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he scored it, and we won 1-0.
Right.
So it's about the moment. I mean, I'm not criticising him here, you know, by the way.
You don't have any ill feeling about
towards
him now?
No. Deitch is a great lad. I love him to bits. Right. I think he's living in Toronto now. He's been coaching and everything over there. But yeah, he's a great lad. It's the moment. Look, he's younger than I was. Mm. Darren Williams and Jody Craddock are younger than me. Mm. And that was pretty much what was left, other than the goalkeeper. Mm. So I was like, all right, okay, it's my turn. Mm. So then you've got, your mindset changes pretty quick.
How do you feel walking up?
Longest walk of your life.
Yeah. Are you aware of the moment, or are you on autopilot? Oh, yeah. Or
no, you're wary of it. I mean, you try and block everything out. I mean, I must admit, I think it was a silent walk, although it wasn't. Mm. But you try and get down to it as quick as you possibly can. You're thinking, right, okay, do I need to walk? Do I need to jog, etc.? I'll just do it my own way. And as you're going up to the penalty spot, you're kind of choosing where you're going to put the ball. The ones that you're taking in training, the one that you think you feel most comfortable with. And then you see, I got there, I put the ball in the penalty spot, and I seen Sasha, who's a big lad. And then it's decision time. I've made my mind up, and I've stepped back from it, and then it's just basically running to the ball and thinking, right, just please let this go in the back of the net.
Did you execute it as you wanted to?
No, it was awful.
My penalty
was crap.
Yeah, you scuffed it.
It was, well, not so much scuffed it. I just didn't get as much pace on it as I thought I wanted to.
Because you were tired or because of nervous?
Might have been a little bit of that, a little bit of nerves of thinking, just don't miss the target.
Were you not tempted to smash it as hard as you could?
Yeah, I was. But I'm kind of a confident person. Once I'd made my mind up, I wasn't going to change it.
Right.
But as I was running up and I took the shot, I knew where I was going to. And as soon as you've hit the ball, you know, first initial thought is it on target? Mm. Second is, where's the keeper? And I seen Sasha jumping across to his left-hand side, and I knew he had made great contact with it. And from that moment, I knew he'd saved it. You know, what I said before, you know, it wasn't a brilliant penalty. And I seen him jumping across to his left-hand side, and it was like, oh no.
It's so cruel because it's finished there and then because it's sudden death. You're a local kid. It meant obviously, I would say, I mean, you're obviously going to humbly say it means a lot to everyone, of course, but it probably meant more to you than most.
Mm.
And then you must have, I mean, it's difficult to explain how you must have felt in that sort of moment, because you must have felt the loneliest person in the world at that point.
Well, nobody can get you ready for it.
No.
You know, you can take 100 penalties in training, or you can go to a stadium, an empty stadium, and take 100 penalties if you like. Nobody can get you ready for that moment.
Mm.
And as I said before, you know, we didn't have shrinks, if you want to call them that, or you know, anybody like that.
Yeah, no support. Well, exactly. You've actually said, it's a quote here, straight after the match, they were singing my name, and as I was walking down the tunnel, I could hear my name being sung, which gave me a real lift. Mm. When I got back to pre-season training, there was a sack full of male waiting for me, just saying how they would have hated to be in that situation and praising the fact that I was brave enough to step up and take it.
Yeah.
So the fans were amazing to
fans
you.
Fans were absolutely incredible. As I was walking off, obviously the Wembley turf, and going down the tunnel.
Were you in tears?
I was in the dressing room a little bit. It was head down first.
Did the players come round you?
There was a few of the other players, you know, and it wasn't just me. But again, you know, it's silence. Mm. Honestly, the amount of players would probably tell you that, you know, and they've had a disappointment. But when you go in a dressing room, nobody really wants to say anything. You know, you're waiting for your coach or somebody like that. And Bobby Saxton, who we had as a coach for a long, long time, who was absolutely top draw. Brilliant fun. Mm. But, you know, when it was serious business come around, you know, he knew his stuff. Really experienced guy. And then obviously Peter Reid alongside him, Adrian Heath, people like that. Paul Bracewell, who was in charge, or was involved, should I say. So you're just waiting. And then the first few words come out, probably the manager's, you know, again, the same thing. Look, so proud of you. You know, I'm absolutely gutted that I'm not being able to do it. But, you know, there's always next season. And it was Niall Quinn after that. He basically stood up and just went, listen, guys, next season we're going to take this league by storm. We all stay together. We're going to take this league by storm.
Which, of course, you did.
Mm.
But did you feel responsible solely in that moment?
Yeah, yeah. I did.
And there was no talking to you?
No, I was pretty silent. I mean, and again, you know, on the way home, we'd organised a celebratory party halfway back. With the supporters, the wives, the girlfriends and the kids and everything were on the coaches behind us. So we did, we stopped off. We got off. Same thing, sat down, had a couple of beers, and then it was like, right, just get me back on the coach. Got back on the coach and I was silent. But that wasn't a nice feeling.
But do you think, looking back on it now, because obviously Sunderland went on the following season to get over 100 points and storm the division as Niall Quinn said you would, do you think it gave you a lot of fuel, a lot of drive to
I mean,
since, it's the making of you, really.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I always pinpoint one part of my career where I think, right, what kick-started me?
So you wouldn't change it? Well, because you ended up playing for England.
Would you, yeah, you know? I suppose so. Thinking of it like that.
It's easy for me to say, of
course. I know. But the good thing about it, and this is where I talk about great managers when you've worked for one. So the season finished, I went home, closed the doors. Peter Reid phoned me up. He went, he said, what are you doing? I said, not a lot. He said, right, you're coming to stay with me for a couple of days.
Did he?
Yeah. So I went and stayed with Peter Reid for a couple of days. Then about a day after that, I went on holiday to Ayanapa, which I don't know if you know this story, but
system.
When I got there, the first person I bumped into in the first pub that I walked in was Clyde Mendonca.
Was it really?
Seriously.
What did he say?
He was at the back, and I remember seeing him. He was sat with his wife, and I walked up to the back of the pub in Ayanapa, because we were still young lads then, and a few of us had went away. And I just went, I don't believe this. Yeah. You know, it was like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
And then it was like, look, fair play to you. You were absolutely different class. Yeah. Like, sat down, he bought me a beer, or I bought him a beer, whichever way it was. And then just went, I said, right, good luck to you next season, right? You've done absolutely brilliant. I hope you enjoy the Premier League. And he was like, right, good luck, because he's a Sunderland lad. He said, I really want you to come up whenever the next season.
But in all the bars and all the world, Mickey.
Oh, I couldn't, honestly, it was
unbelievable. People taking the piss out of you.
And I was like, wow, is this actually happening? Has someone just planted him there?
Yeah.
It was crazy, it was. And for the rest of the holiday, I don't actually think I saw him. It was just the first day. We went in this place and I was like, This is not right.
It's crazy.
It was either going to be him or Sasha, really.
Yeah. Who would you have preferred?
Well, probably Clive, to be honest. Sasha's a big lad, so yeah, I think I might have had a pint with him and then ran away. But
the following season, you obviously played so well that you were called up for England.
Yeah, playing in the Championship.
And that's an amazing achievement, that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you talk about the goals that Kevin got. I mean, we knew Kevin was special. Not at the time when he joined the club. You know, I think he had to answer a lot to the players that were around him to show how good he was, but it didn't take him long.
And what do you remember? Because it would have been Kevin Keegan as a manager at the time, right?
Yeah.
So what do you remember the call? Did you just get a phone call at home?
I did, yeah.
Was there talk about it in the press beforehand? Were you expecting it, or was it completely out of the blue?
I think there was more talk about Kevin Phillips, to be honest with you.
Well, he's getting the goals, he's the eye-catching
absolutely.
Player. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then I got the phone call the same day as Kevin. And rang him up when I went. I said, have you just had that call? He went, yeah. He said, are you in the squad? I went, I said, yeah. And they announced it and everything. Kevin Keegan come on the phone. It was like, hi, Mickey, it's Kevin Keegan.
Yeah.
Listen, congratulations. We'd just like to let you know that you're a part of the next squad. And I'm like, is this one of my mates? So it was, no, it's the, and then the more I heard his voice, I was like, oh, Kevin, I'm really sorry. Absolutely fantastic. You know, it's like dream come true and everything. I had to make sure you weren't one of my friends winding me up.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, it's definitely me. Make sure you're all prepared. Get yourself ready. Get your boots and everything. Come and join us. You deserve to be there. You and Kevin have had a fantastic season. Come in. You're part of the squad. Make sure you're part of this big squad of Premier League players. Just because you're playing the Championship, don't think you don't deserve your place.
Right.
So that was like a weight off the shoulders straight away. Kevin Keegan was brilliant.
Have you been at that point, had you been linked to Premier League clubs in transfer terms and you just decided not to go because you love Sunderland, or what was the situation?
Bits and bobs in papers.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
I didn't really buy into that in them days, to be honest with you.
Okay,
I was so focused on getting Sunderland in the Premier League.
What was it like being a Championship player in that squad of England players at that time?
Strange.
Right.
Because you'd probably played against four or five of them in FA Cup games or League Cup games. But to go in was pretty weird.
What were they like to you?
Most of them were all right.
Okay.
There was others that weren't. You know, there was four or five tables with everybody on it. You know, some of them with players on, and there was another one in the corner with staff.
You must have known Beckham would have been in there, right?
Yeah, Beckham, Scholes, he was in there, yeah.
So you knew those guys from
before? I knew
them
a little bit, but the Man United players didn't really get involved. They'd come in, they'd sit on their own table all together, have their food, and then they were off back in the rooms.
Really? Okay.
Never mingled with the rest of them. I don't know if that was subconscious, or I don't think that was the manager saying to them, don't mingle with any other players.
Really?
Yeah, because they were winning everything at the time, weren't they?
Yeah, really? Yeah, yeah.
But then we had Alan Shearer, we had Gareth Southgate, we had
well, they would have just won the treble, wouldn't they?
That, yeah, absolutely. Mm. And then they had, you know, David Seaman was there. I think David James was actually there. Nigel Martin. Mm. You know, people like that. And they were great. You know, me and Kevin, obviously, you know, I followed him around and he did exactly the same thing with me. You know, we ate together. When he got up to have something to eat, I went. When he went to the toilet, I went to the toilet.
So there was no mingling, intermingling at all in that, at that point?
Just a hi, lads, how are you doing? Listen, congratulations for getting me in the squad. Jamie Redknapp was really good as well. I remember Jamie being really good. Yeah. But then we played Hungary and then we went to Bulgaria.
Yeah.
And I think Kevin got injured after the Hungary game. Kevin Phillips got injured. So I think he had to go home.
Right.
And we played against Bulgaria, so I'm there on my own then.
Right.
I'm in my room. And I'm like, oh, crikey, what's going on here?
No one really took you under their wing or anything like that?
Well, yeah.
I know you don't want to speak ill of anyone. You don't have to name names.
No. There were certain ones that made it, I wouldn't say difficult. You just didn't go out the way to make you welcome. You had to go and approach them.
Right.
When they were probably experienced players in that squad.
Yeah.
You would think they would come across to you.
Yeah.
You know, first initial time in the squad, it's like, oh, no.
Hmm.
Right, really nervous. Second time you're in there, right? We'd stayed away because we'd done the two games. That was really, really nervy.
Mm.
But I'd say most of them were brilliant. And Kevin Keegan and Arthur Cox and Derek Fasakli and the coaching staff, Ray Clements was there as well. I mean, they were brilliant.
So we sometimes on this show have a little bit of a laugh about Kevin Keegan because he comes across as quite sort of clumsy and a little bit.
Yeah.
But you say he was great to play for.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I mean,
he was a great player, of course.
I wasn't thinking about tactics at the time, okay? And I know people have said in the past, you know, he's tactically wasn't as good as some of the managers right now.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Kevin Keegan as a man and as a person and what he did for me.
Mm.
He was incredible.
Right.
Just made me feel so comfortable. Took me out of the five-a-side training sessions, which he used to do with a lot of players, and then bring you out and do one touch and two touch and everything, and then put you back into the five-a-sides. And then he told me, the game I started, the Bulgaria game, he went, he said, right, you're starting, you're playing. Have it in your head. A day before, you know you're playing.
Who was the other left-back in the squad at that point?
There was Graeme Lasso.
Yeah. Phil Neville?
Phil Neville, I think, might have been the squad. But we travelled. I think we travelled away with the under-21s. So there was people like Danny Mills who were in. I think he got actually drafted into it. Stuart Pearce, I think, got drafted in to one of them because there was injuries and suspensions,
right, okay,
etc. We had Sol Campbell, who played as a left-sided centre-back when we played Bulgaria. I actually played as a wing-back.
Yeah.
What
did it feel like to play for England?
I've never done it before.
Really?
Yeah.
It's funny because I think maybe some people listening will think, well, how much can you really learn about at that point in terms of doing one touch and two touch when you're already playing for the England senior team?
Mm.
But that's still a big part of it. And
Yeah, that was what Kevin used to do. I mean, he used to obviously pull all the players out and then shooting at the end of training, all the centre forwards. Only centre forwards are having shots, and then Scholesy would just turn it. We go, right, okay.
Okay.
Go on, Scholesy, right. Mickey, okay, can you go on the left hand side? I can't remember who's out on the right hand side.
Gary Neville, probably.
Oh, David Beckham.
Oh, yeah, Beckham, yeah.
Just like on the byline, pinging balls back to the edge of the D on the 18 yard box, and they're all just volleying them into the top corners, etc.
What was the standard of the training like?
Oh, scary.
Was it?
Yeah. I mean, the quality was just brilliant.
Right.
You know, I was like, right, well, this is it.
Right.
This is as good as it's
going
to
get. Don't get any better than that, yeah.
No, I mean, Shearer, Scholes, Beckham, you know, Sheringham, Heskey, Robbie Fowler.
Some not good players back then, eh?
Jonathan Woodgate had just got into the squad as well.
Yeah.
I think he'd made his debut in that Hungary game as well. David Batty.
Hmm.
The list goes on. You know, Seaman, I was talking about, Sol Campbell.
Yeah.
Tony Adams, Martin Keown.
Yeah.
You know, it's not bad, is it?
No.
You know, we think about, you know, Alan Shearer. I don't even know if I mentioned him.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It was a top quality squad of players.
And what did it feel like to earn your first cap?
That's up there with, like I said before, making your debut.
Yeah.
You know, depending, if somebody asks you what you want to do as a youngster, you go, right, I want to play professional football, but I want to play for England or whichever country you're involved in. But that would be it. Making your debut for me.
Hmm.
And then I think scoring a goal and England. They're the three things for me. And then after that, you go, right, a trophy here, a trophy there, or a promotion, etc. Mm. They will come after that for me. But I think as an individual, the selfishness would say, obviously make your debut, scoring a goal. And then, you know, it's just that way. That's the way that you think.
How do you,
for your country.
Three kits. So you got three caps. I think I was at the Sweden game, the 0-0. Did Paul Scholes get sent off?
Scholes got sent off.
Yeah, I was at that game.
So I came on again at half time.
Yeah.
It quite happened a few times that, me, to be honest with you. But Graeme Lasseur went off. I think he'd had a thigh problem. So you look around the squad and you're thinking, right, okay, who can play left back? You know, is it going to be me, or is he going to change the system and play with a wing back? If he's going to do that, I don't think it's going to be me who's playing. But straight away it was like, right, Mickey, you're gone. You're on. Are you ready?
And what do you feel like your level was compared to Graeme Lasseur?
Well, you always aspire to someone. I mean, Graeme, you know, was an established player then. Mm. I mean, I don't know how many caps he'd had at the time, but when I watched the games on TV,
he was playing.
It was always Graeme Lasseur.
Yeah.
It was Stuart Pearce, and then it was Graeme Lasseur. And then I think from that moment, you know, that was it. Mm. You know, odd ones here and there might have, you know, came into the squad, but that was it. I'd got into the squad. So it was like, if I'm going to be a first team regular, I've got to be as good as Graeme Lasseur, and I've got to be as good as Stuart Pearce. Mm. But it was probably more so Lasseur at the time. And then you think to yourself in training, have I done better than him? You know, that's how competitive it was, you know, because he's obviously playing different sides. And I'm watching what he's doing. I'm going, right, okay, I need to do something good because he's just done something good.
But the reason I ask is because when I interviewed Jamie Carragher for this, he said it got to the point where he would say, right, John Terry and Rio Ferdinand, they're better than me. Mm. And I know they're better than me, but I'll settle for being the third best centre-back in England. Did you ever think like that, or was that not part of your makeup?
No, I think when you're in that squad, I think you're there to play.
Yeah,
I mean, look, them guys, now what can I say about their careers? Absolutely nothing, you know, I'm phenomenal. But I'm looking at Graeme Lasseur when I got in that squad thinking, right, I want that spot. I want number three. Mm. That's where I want to play. I don't want to sit and watch. Mm. And that's what it's all about, that competitive edge inside you, that greed of wanting to play for your country and wanting to play there every single time that the squad gets named.
Do you think that if you played for a more fashionable club, you'd have more than three caps?
Maybe. You know, I think after playing for England, I knew that there was other people who were on the phone, giving phone calls then, different clubs.
Yeah. Would you have gone?
I had the opportunity to go to them, but then you get offered a new contract at the club that you're at. Hmm. You're settled, you've got a family, your kids and everything are there. Do you want to move at the time? And it was all them things that go through your mind. And I just thought, no, I'm happy with the contract that I'm signing. I want to stay where I am. If I'm good enough, I'll still get in the squad. Hmm. You have a dip in form, you don't get in it.
Yeah.
And then you think, right, have I made the right decision here?
And so when you look back on your international career, there's no kind of unfinished business resentment. You just think it is what it is, and I played for England, and that's great.
No, I think I'd like to play more. Mm. You know, I think once you've been involved in it and you've had a little taste of what it's like and, you know, what it means to the whole country, you obviously want to play more. Mm. But just to make one would have been special, but to have three is pretty darn good. But we played a game at the Stadium of Light when we were travelling around the country playing at different grounds. And I was obviously in the squad. We'd stayed in a hotel in Newcastle. We travelled down to the game, and Kevin actually named the squad when we got into the dressing room and the subs. Mm. And I wasn't even on the bench.
Right.
Steve Guppy, I think, made his debut as a left wing back. I don't know if you remember the game at Stadium of Light. Jamie Redknapp scored an absolute scream on his left foot. No, I wasn't even on the bench.
Right.
That was gutting. That hurt.
I bet.
Yeah.
You think he would have given you 5 minutes?
Yeah. Well, like, you know, not even to put me on the bench.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That was... Yeah, I just thought, you know, you're travelling around the country, you've got two players here who play for Sunderland. Mm. I've got the chance for you to put me on the bench. I mean, it was 6, 7, 8 substitutes at the time as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't even get on the bench.
Do you think he wouldn't have done that on purpose, though, would he?
No. And like I said to you before, you know, Kevin was wonderful to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely, 100% top guy. Mm. Whether he thought that, you know, I hadn't been good in training or my form wasn't good getting called up to the England squad or whatever it may be, he just went with his gut feeling. And that sometimes you've got to accept.
He can't keep everyone happy, can he, all the time?
Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, it would have been nice.
Do you look back on your career and think of anything that could have been different, or any, I mean, you're just very happy with what you achieved? Do you think you achieved everything you thought was possible when you were a kid? For your ability and for your talent?
Yeah, I think you always say to yourself when you finish, could I have done more? Mm. Yeah, there's always that in the back of your mind. You know, maybe not for the, you know, the top class players who go on and win 14 trophies and European trophies and everything. But I think when you've only won the championship a couple of times and you finished seventh back-to-back in the Premier League, and I think we did that with Blackburn, I think we have finished sixth or seventh, you always think to yourself, you know, could I have done more? What did I do wrong? That I would change. Mm. But did I have a great time doing it? 100%. Mm.
And when you stepped down a level as you got a bit older, did you enjoy it less because it wasn't as intense and you weren't playing with as good players?
Yeah, I think that my age was 33. Mm. 33 when I went to Sheffield Wednesday. Great club. Mm. Absolutely loved it and had a really good rapport with the supporters. Well, training sessions, the levels, the commitment of the players, what I seen them get up to was just completely not what I was about.
Right.
And I went into training to work hard every day of the week and then give everything I had on a match day. Whether, you know, the supporters thought I had a good game or a bad game, I'd come off absolutely shattered because I knew I'd given everything. And I went to Sheffield Wednesday and it was, I could switch off. I could easily switch off because I seen other players doing it.
Still be good enough.
Well, yeah, you knew you were one of the better players. You know, I was 33, 34 at the time, but I just seen the attitude of players and the dip from what I'd been through my career, you know, at Sunderland for many years and then Blackburn, Celtic and Leeds United and Wolves even with Mick McCarthy. The training sessions were just absolutely top draw. And then I went down to Sheffield Wednesday. It was nothing to do with the managers that I was under. It was just the attitude of the players, yeah.
Can I ask you a quick question before you go?
A
cheeky one. Is it true you turned up to training in a Ferrari and were fined by Mick McCarthy for doing it?
I did turn up in the Ferrari.
Yeah.
Fined, no.
Okay.
The problem with that story is people obviously, you know, they add things on the bill bits and, you know, make it into a book, if you like. Yeah. I'd ordered that car 3 months prior.
Have you still got it?
No, I'm not. You're joking. I need a crowbar to get me out of one of them now. But I'd ordered it 3 months before.
Okay.
Now, you can imagine a lad from Castletown like I was.
Yeah.
You know, I'd had absolutely nothing.
Mm.
My dream car turns up 3 months after I'd ordered it.
Mm.
I'm going to leave it outside my house and go to the training ground.
Mm.
It was never, ever going to happen. So I pulled into the training ground. When I pulled into the training ground, we had a meeting upstairs. And the meeting was 90 people have just left their jobs at the football club.
Right.
So I find it out when I'm in the training ground. So my car's already there.
You didn't know that in advance.
No.
Yeah.
So Mick McCarthy then said to me, he said, look, do you mind driving it home? And I went, not a problem.
Yeah.
Not a problem.
Yeah.
So I took it home and I came back and got on with training.
But
no fines, nothing.
But the papers picked up on that and said, oh, yeah.
And I know exactly who it was, but if I ever do a book,
okay, right,
I'll bring out the full
story.
Watch
this space. Oh, can I ask you one more quick question as well before you go? Did you have a fist fight with Wayne Rooney?
Well, I didn't really have a fist fight, no, but he thumped me on a night out once, yeah. You can ask me what you like, Lou.
Okay.
I don't mind.
I'm just interested because you told me a story once where you said the newspapers got a hold of that and they photoshopped you a black eye.
Oh, no, they did colour it.
To make it look better.
It was actually on Match of the Day, and even on there, they'd made my eye look completely blacked out.
Yeah, but it was just a little quick, it was a quick sort of scuffle.
It was one punch.
Yeah.
It was one punch in a club that we all used to go to, you know, Manchester, Blackburn, Man City players, you know, whoever played around that area. And we went to this club one night and we had a bit of a fracas and Wayne punched me once and that was it. The doorman came in, I left, I think he left as well and that was the taxi. Next day, there was about 15 paparazzi outside of the big bush outside of my house.
How do they even hear about it?
Oh, well,
barman or something like that.
Who knows?
About,
yeah. Who knows? The club itself. And then the same day I drove down to the training ground again. There was another 15 or 20. The press were there. The papers, Sky were there.
Finally.
I just kept my head down, drove into the training ground with sunglasses on and a cap, started training. So I had nothing from that. And then it was Match of the Day on that Saturday. We played Sheffield United and I was standing on the touchline. A big camera must have zoomed in on me.
Yeah,
and they just coloured my eye in. But he did punch me, but I didn't have a black eye.
No, okay. You've been very generous with your time, Mickey. Thank
Pleasure,
you so
mate.
Much. It's been great to hear about your career, and I think hopefully people listening would have enjoyed it as well. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Could have been here for hours, mate. Loved that.
We kind of were. But I know you've got to get up and do
I'm
stuff.
I'm getting a kick up the backside now.
And all the very best, mate, and we'll catch up again soon, I'm sure.
Top man.
Cheers, Mickey. Thanks
pal.
This was a Radio Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
time then?
I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.